Okay, we'll proceed to the third case of the morning, which is the United States v. James Hanlon. Mr. Locker.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Bruce Loescher from Springfield, and I represent Jim Hanlon. This case comes before the court on convictions of Mr. Hanlon for conspiracy, arson, mail fraud, and committing a fire, another offense. We submit that this case resulted in an unfair trial and denial of due process to Mr. Hanlon.
Refresh my recollection, what was the town involved?
Pardon me?
What town is involved in the...
It's a small town, principally a small town just east of Springfield called Iliopolis.
That's what I understood. Is there anything left of the town?
Well, it used to be an arsenal.
Well, it sounds like it was now an arsenal.
And then Borden.
Anything left unburned? Or
yeah.
They missed a couple of houses,
yeah.
Did they?
Yeah, there's a. Matter of fact, one of its claims to fame, I think, is a prairie land dance corral where people go from all over central Illinois to country line dance.
A corral, though, it's outdoors.
No, it's inside.
No building. Still intact, is it?
Yes, sir.
It's something they overlooked.
In July of 2002, this indictment was returned by a grand jury. And there had been an investigation, of course, done by the federal government. And during the course of the investigation, the government issued a subpoena to Mr. Hanlon. Mr. Hanlon responded to that subpoena. There was no indication, no admonishments given to Mr. Hanlon, nothing to indicate to Mr. Hanlon that he had any rights whatsoever or could deny or refuse to appear or refuse to testify. He responded to that subpoena and did testify, giving in excess of 50 pages of testimony before the grand jury, where the U.S. attorney asked him everything they wanted to know about their investigation.
But he was not in custody.
He was not in custody.
Doesn't Miranda address itself to custodial interrogation?
It does.
Well, then what's the problem here of failure to give warnings?
Well, the problem is that because he was subpoenaed, he was coerced.
Oh, no question about that. I mean, being coerced is different, however, than being in custody.
Well,
to follow your thought on this, if I may jump ahead, would we be required to give the Miranda warning to any prospective defendant who is subpoenaed before a grand jury?
No.
What makes this one unique?
This is unique because the case law is that if he testifies on that, what he's doing is he's testifying. Any statement he makes is involuntary.
Why is it involuntary?
Because it's coerced. The Supreme Court. The Supreme Court.
The Miranda doesn't come into play at all. It's something else.
The state of the case law is right now, as I understand it, is that they're not required to give you the Miranda. There's a policy rule in the Department of Justice that you're not supposed to.
30-some-odd years ago, the U.S. attorney had a policy in this circuit, in this district, to give the Miranda warnings to prospective defendants who appear, but it was not required.
Right.
Well, I did it out of the generosity of my heart. But I wanted to know if there was a rule on the subject, because what you want us to do is impose such a rule, as near as I can tell.
Well, no, I think what you can do is just follow the case law that was laid out by the U.S. Supreme Court when in Manduyeno they talked about, number one, the broad coercive power of the federal grand jury, and secondly, in the Portash case, where they said if you use this testimony, which is compelled, without those admonishments, for any purpose in a criminal trial, it's a denial of due process.
That's what they said.
I believe so, yes. And we feel that his testimony was, in essence, involuntary, and no involuntary statement can be used against
the
defendant.
Isn't it only compelled if it's given over a grant of immunity?
Pardon me?
I thought it would only be considered compelled if it's given over a grant of immunity.
No, I don't believe so.
So you disappear before a grand jury and you testify.
Yeah.
Anything you say
can't
be used against
you. In the context in which Mr. Hanlon appeared, he was, at a minimum, the subject of the grand jury's investigation. Hmm. May have been a target, but he was at least a subject of their investigation.
Subject of interest, they say now.
I'm sorry, sir?
A person of interest, they say.
Yeah, a person of interest now.
And he could have taken a fifth.
He could have. He didn't know he could have.
Oh, come on. Does anybody not know that they could take a fifth?
You're talking about a man who right now is...
Mr. Hanlon, he didn't know anything about the Fifth Amendment, I guess.
Well, he had no criminal record. He had no... he was a man who is now about almost 71. He'll be 71 years old next month. Suffers for a
ride. He's not even Holden Bauer.
True. But, yeah, he didn't... He testified. He answered... answered all their questions, and then subsequently when the trial came about, the government used his testimony in for purposes of impeachment.
Right.
Now, I'm sorry.
Now, Harris would permit that anyway, wouldn't it?
I'm sorry, sir?
Even if there had been a Miranda warning and he had, and they precluded the evidence going in the first instance, it would be available to the government under most circumstances for cross-examination, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Okay, well, what's the difference now? Now you've got the next step forward. And then
well, I mean, and that's what the government said. Well, we're being magnanimous in this. We know we screwed up here. So we are...
And they admit they screwed up, or just let it go at that?
They did. And they said, you know, we won't use it in our case in chief, but we reserve the right to use it for purposes of impeachment.
Now, that's the magnanimous part. They don't have to tell you.
The judge said, okay, we'll let that be. And that's exactly what happened. They used it to impeach him. And then to add to that over-objection, the court gave the instruction which said to the jury that, listen, if you find out that there's some contradictory testimony that he gave in his testimony before you, contradictory in that it contradicted what he had supposedly told the grand jury, then you can use that in deciding his credibility, and his credibility not only as to what the impeaching part was, but as to all his testimony. So we submit that was extremely prejudicial to Mr. Hanlon. But that was compounded by the fact that the charge in this case, or charges in this case, involve, like I say, an investigation of fires that had occurred initially in 96 and 97, and then the government went back and expanded their case and went back all the way to 1991 and combined that in one huge conspiracy indictment. The evidence was that Mr. Hanlon did not participate in any fires that occurred in 91 or 94 or even in the first part of 96. There was some evidence based on those cooperating witnesses that he was involved in fires occurring in the latter part of 96. But the government once wanted to include these earlier fires because, number one, make Hanlon and Ham look bad, but secondly, it would get them around the statute of limitations. And then they could get in all this co-conspirator hearsay and the... there's no doubt that Hanlon wasn't involved in those earlier fires. Now, what we're saying is that don't consider this, and the court shouldn't have considered this as a group, all these fires, but consider it looking at the agreement. And the agreement for these, each of these fires in 91 and 94 and 96 was that you commit the fire. In this case, it was Billy Rogers and Ham conspiring. They did the fire, and Rogers was paid. Then there was months later, there was another fire. These were all either for insurance purposes for Ham or to get rid of Ham's competitors. There's no indication that Hamlin benefited from these fires. His own place was burned.
Well, assuming the kind of, you know, we're talking a conspiracy, the fact that he joined the conspiracy late doesn't immunize him from what happens in the totality of the conspiracy.
No, it wouldn't if there was a continuing conspiracy.
Yeah, well, that's the question.
Yeah, but there wasn't a
continuing conspiracy. Well, that's what you said. I understand your position on it.
Okay.
But assuming the existence of one, take that. Then it's perfectly permissible to put in all the other evidence and the other fires in order to show the conspiracy itself and the extent of it.
If there was a continuing conspiracy.
So that's the nub of the case.
Yeah.
Kadiakis is the one we're worried about.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. And so the... Okay, so we have those multiple conspiracies. We said that there was an individual agreement as to each of those. They should have been considered separately, and that, even though they charged it as one, they proved multiple, and therefore we say there was a variance, and it was a prejudicial variance because of all the other evidence they were able to bring in. And another factor is, quoting from the trial court, when she sentenced Mr. Hanlon, and if the trial court was wrong, then you can understand how the jury was confused. Because in her sentencing order, Judge Scott said, quote, at his trial, defendant Hanlon testified that he wasn't involved in the planning or consummation of the fires at Johnson's Grocery, a 91 fire, Joe's Company Store, 91 fire, Habits and Vices, Granny's Pub and Grub, I think it was 94, Corn Crib was 97. The evidence presented at the trial overwhelmingly demonstrated that the defendant played an integral role in these fires. He wasn't there. He had no role. There was no evidence that he was there or played a role in those fires. But the court used that to, number one, increase his penalty, find it bootstrapped, she found him guilty of obstructing justice.
The Corn Crib one was after he had him.
That's right. That was in 97. That was in 97.
So maybe she just misspoke after the other.
Possibly. But then the court, the prosecution also used these multiple mail fraud and fires to introduce these other crimes involving two alleged cigarette thefts. One in 91, when the defendant wasn't around there, and another one after the last fire in 97, Brockmeyer. And the government represented to the judge that these were for insurance purposes. And that's the reason she allowed that testimony in, was that it was another indication of a conspiracy to defraud insurance companies. There was no absolutely no evidence for that.
You're in your rebuttal time.
I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry. I just wanted you to know about it.
And then the judge in sentencing said it was error. It was error to admit that evidence. But she says, in light of all the other evidence in the case, it was harmless error. And she sustained the defendant's conviction. Thank you.
What do you think? Mr. Gilmore?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Greg Gilmore for the United States. Counsel. Your Honors, counsel started speaking about the error that was made in subpoenaing the defendant to the grand jury.
Oh, you don't say the error wasn't subpoenaing him. The error was in asking questions without giving a warning.
That's true, Your Honor. Thank you, Judge Bauer. That's true. And counsel talks about Portish, the case
of Portish. He says also the government admitted they made a mistake. Is that true? Do you think you did it wrong?
Your Honor, I
violating the law, not the general guidelines of the Department of Justice.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that I violated the law. I did violate the DOJ policy, and I did self-report that to my boss and also to the Department of Justice. So I did indeed make a mistake.
And so that's why you acquiesced in the suppression of that testimony.
Yes, Your Honor.
Preserving it from the Harris rule.
Yes, Your Honor. Portish does not say that what happened here was involuntary. What it says is involuntary statements or involuntary statements made involuntarily cannot be used. But it does not say that what happened in this case amounted to involuntary statements. They were voluntary statements. So I believe counsel is incorrect in saying that. Your Honor, also, in regards to the jury instruction, counsel did object to the jury instruction, but however, he did not submit an alternative instruction, and the defense states that the instruction talked about the defendant's prior testimony and how that can be used. That's not quite right. Your Honor's instruction number 16, the Seventh Circuit, your pattern instruction 310, reads, a statement made by a defendant before trial, not testimony made before trial. In other words, there was no focusing in on the grand jury testimony, and it's important because in this case, the defendant's statements did come into evidence. There was an undercover tape recording that was made, a fairly long tape recording, where he made a large amount of statements concerning these fires, the U-Haul feigned accident, basically the conspiracy. Additionally, there were other statements the defendant made, co-conspirator statements that came in. So jury instruction 16 did not focus in on these two limited areas of cross-examination. Counsel also, in the reply brief, talks about how the questions that were used for impeachment were collateral. That's not quite accurate, I do not believe. Your Honor, there was questions regarding whether the defendant was present when stock was moved out of the, or if he assisted in moving stock out of the place that was to be burned a few days later. And in grand jury, he stated he did assist. At trial, he stated he did not. And the other question was whether James Clapp was present in the grand when the stock was moved out shortly before the trial. And in the grand jury, he stated that he was. And at trial, he stated that he was not present. So a co-conspirator, whether he was present and assisting in moving stock out of the bar that was burned a few days later, was a direct piece of evidence to the conspiracy, Your Honors. Your Honors, in regards to these statements that were made in the various conspiracies, there are a lot of facts that show that there was a large single conspiracy in this case, and not multiple conspiracies. There are similarities based on what was burned or what happened here. The small bar or convenience store, gas cans were used in all of the arsons. 7 out of the 9 arsons, if you include attempted arsons, there was a flare that was used. In all of the cases, the torch was paid after the fact. There was no prepaying. They didn't renegotiate roles before each crime took place. In other words, there was nobody wanting to be the foreperson this time or changing roles. They were set in their roles. There was this prolonged cooperation that took place over the course of 6 or 7 years and this large amount of crimes. There was a division of labor as far as Mr. Hamm and the defendant acted as the people that would call the shots and direct people. The defendant's role, specific role, was to act as the foreman. He'd make sure that the jobs were done, they were done right, and then he would pay them based on money that was given through Mr. Hamm or from Mr. Hamm. The other co-conspirators, that's Mr. Clapp, Mr. Bennett, Mr. Rogers, they always acted as the underlings or the people that took the most risk. As the district court stated, they were the ones that would take the greatest risks. The defendant, this is District Court Rule Record 149, page 7 and 8, clearly showed the pecking order within the conspiracy. Ham and Hanlon, who's the defendant, gave the orders while Bennett, Clapp, and Rogers took the greatest risks. This showed their relationship and their intent in acting in concert. And moreover, Your Honors, it showed the roles that each of them played. So, Your Honor, if there were no questions, I would ask you to affirm the District Court, and thank you for your time.
Anything? Do you have anything to add, folks? You got about a minute. Okay. I understand you were court appointed, is that correct? You were court appointed? I appreciate you taking the assignment and the work for your client.
That is well appreciated.
Thanks very much. Case will be taken under advisement. Move on to the next case.